the content business is one I've really been in for my entire career.
This is Content Content, a monthly podcast featuring the people behind the content. I'm Ed Marsh. This episode was recorded June 20th, 2018. Today's guest is Mr. Cruz Saunders, founder and principal at Bracket A Bracket. It's kind of like the print symbol, but actually it's known as Simple A, which you can find at simplea.com and also in Austin, Texas. Cruz is also the author of Content Engineering for a Multi-Channel World, and as a bald man, I am incredibly jealous of his head of hair.
I was a sysop on a BBS way back when we used to dial into computer-mediated environments where humans had a chance to connect and compare ideas within an abstract space that was other than the physical world. And so that's been many, many years ago. And since then, I've been in every computer-mediated environment that's ever existed, both in early days of the internet, even before there was a really strong presence for the hypertext protocols, and then started developing a sense of content management when I founded an interactive agency back in it was internet consulting back in 1995, and then it was an interactive agency. After that, that grew up in the early days of the internet, but there was really a very poor job of managing content because everything was manually coded HTML pages. So we developed our own CMS.
Get out of here.
And so that there was many folks in that time that really were working on their own CMSs, and so. That process of creating a CMS was really necessary because there was only very high-end, super expensive ones that were meant for newspaper publishers, and then there was homegrown
right.
ones, and then eventually, you know, as open source came around and some mid-market CMS vendors came around, we eventually abandoned our own platform and became integrators. But we noticed that there was a really poor job being done of connecting the content to the systems of record, to the content management systems. And so we began to focus on that part of the software development lifecycle of the website development process, which was the engineering of the content, and then eventually I found that we became such experts in that one part of the business that other agencies were hiring us to do that for their CMS implementations. And eventually I wrapped up that agency and just focused nonstop on the engineering of content with a new company called A, which is simplea.com. And so A is, really named after the genesis of intelligent content. It's the A is the alpha,
okay.
the beginning of language, and the brackets around it represent markup metadata that append to the beginning of language, so that we have the genesis of intelligent content is really what the company's name means.
Okay.
So. The reason we have the simple in front of it is one, we find that it's very hard to search for A in brackets by itself. So when you add simple in front of it, it helps to make it less ambiguous. But our actual name really just goes by A. That's what our friends call us.
So. Ah, interesting. I did not realize that, but that's very interesting. And it's interesting too, because we're on a journey at work to, kind of build our own CMS, and also we've been working in XSL, as you and I mentioned, talked about in the pre-show, talking about putting out content and putting out XSL and putting out, we're actually exposing our data metadata on the page, and people love it because it's a form of governance. So it's really kind of exciting, and people are finding that useful, especially in the regulated industry in which I work. So cool. I think you've, told us a little bit about Simple A, but can you tell us, Can you tell us more about Simple A and what you're kind of doing? I mean, it seems like you guys are in a pretty advanced place in terms of content and content strategy.
Yeah, so, you know, as we've evolved, we've integrated the thinking around what we were doing with marketing communications and customer experience management platforms and structuring content for interoperable assemblies of various presentations, along with what's happening in the tech comms world. I became an early follower of the writings of Joe Gallner, who is the content philosopher and really a very deep thinker in the space, who intrigued me with his treatise on content engineering, and I'd always been involved in circles, STC circles. In fact, my very first public talk within the industry was back in, I believe it was in 2000 for the Society for Technical Communications Dallas chapter, and it was about what is the internet and how will technical writing change for the internet. And so, you know, the tech comms side of the force was very strong. So we've really kind of brought the tech comms and marcom thinking together, along with the thinking of architects like Joe, who's actually just this year joined us in the form position of a master architect at A. And so we're very, very fortunate to get to work with a portion of his time in that capacity, along with other leaders like Alan Porter and others that we work with in Federation as well. We realize that the industry really kind of needs to form a beginning of some sort of agreement about a framework for making intelligent content happen. You know, Ann Rockley and others have defined intelligent content really cleanly in the past. And it's really very useful, I think, to understand not only the technical underpinnings of intelligent content and the way that structure needs to evolve in order to facilitate it, but also what are the people, processes, and technology platforms that underpin it. And so that's where A has really gone, as we've been investigating the patterns, the meta patterns beyond the technology itself, beyond the systems of record, the structural and semantic patterns, along with people process that help to facilitate content intelligence at scale. And so we've been working with some of the world's largest organizations and the biggest content sets, mostly behind the scenes. We don't win a lot of awards or submit ourselves like a interactive agency to the market as a marketing leader or anything like that. We're really trying to work with owners of large numbers of content assets to facilitate the movement of those assets to interact with customers at scale by applying a set of patterns. One of the patterns is our overall content intelligence framework, and the A Content Intelligence Framework is a 7-part framework that helps us to really connect all of the dots between strategy, structure, semantics, systems, standards, and various delivery formats that need to be the recipients of all of our structured and semantically connected content sets. And so we've also learned a ton from our clients. We found that that clients are each working on different parts of the content intelligence process in different ways, both within tech comms and within marcom and in other parts of the organization that are consumers and users of valuable content assets. Ultimately, our objective at A is to elevate the conversation to the C level. We understand that It's really only through a change in the way that content is sponsored that we're really going to get to content intelligence at any large scale within the enterprise. We have been able to make incredible progress working at, with starts inside of marketing organizations, for example. That is just a starting point. When you're looking at the .com, which is one overall presentation of a company's intelligence, you do get a broad view. When we're working on, for example, XML to JSON translations for a chatbot within TechComs, we get a much more micro view. But all of them are built on patterns that really need to be enterprise-wide.
Hmm.
And so that's where we're headed, is how can we create patterns that really make sense to embrace at a organizational level, where the CEO and CFO understand that there are valuable content assets that are driving customer retention, customer adoption of products and services, and customer share of wallet, and that ultimately it's a competitive advantage to pay attention to content assets in a way that's truly strategic, that's not just seen as a one-time P&L spend on the marketing or support P&L. That somebody else inside of an organization manages, and that content is this accidental thing that happens while we're trying to serve customers, or even you know, as in your current role at Goldman Sachs, serve the internal constituents inside of an enterprise, or in marketing to generate leads and drive sales interactions. It's the content is far more than any of those single use cases. It's truly the denominator for all customer experience, ultimately. And so because competition, our ability to compete in the marketplace, is a direct effect of our customer experiences, and our customer experiences are direct effect of our content, we need to look at content assets in a strategic way, and we want to take that message to the C-level directly and start working with the way that content is investments are allocated, and work with creating portfolios of interaction with content between the different silos inside of large enterprises. And so we're not there yet, but we're making progress.
Okay, yeah. But first, I want to take a step back and say, hey, Joe Gallner, if you're listening, I would love to have a content philosopher on the podcast, so please reach out. But I want to talk to you. Okay, you're talking about the content assets in a strategic way at the C-level. And how is that being received? I know it's hard, and especially in a large organization in which I work, it's really hard to get that bubbled up and get that recognition. So how do you, as a consultant, essentially, come in to at the C-level and say, hey, this is something that's worth the spend as a continuing cost instead of, you know, just like you said, like a one-time marketing spend?
Well, ultimately, we think that will be possible when there is a change in the way that content assets are accounted for as intangible intellectual property. But at the moment, it's we're really needing to bubble up, and so we're starting. We're working with some of the largest enterprises with the largest content sets, so we have the ability to impact a lot of strategic level initiatives. For example, CEO oriented mandates towards personalization, or CMO mandates towards the responsive account based intelligent enterprise. And so those mandates are already coming from the C-level, but the assets themselves are not yet accruing to the balance sheet as intellectual property. Yeah. But they really should be. And there's a much bigger conversation that needs to happen with the accounting community and FASB. But, you know, there is a set of bubbling dialogues happening within that market, within academic and analyst community and the accounting and financial community, because other intangible assets within the enterprise are already valued in this way. Of course, we can think of things like goodwill. But when we invest in R&D, we're investing in intellectual property. When we invest in creating an asset like a movie, if we're a movie company, that asset sits on our balance sheet. I mean, of course, it's got value. When we invest in our brand assets, that translates into goodwill. So we're already taking intellectual property and representing its value. But this is the same thing with our data. An organization is receiving tremendous amounts of data from all sides, and that customer data is incredibly valuable. I mean, Amazon's valuation has to be at least largely baked into an understanding of the value of the data that it owns. It just doesn't actually get to capitalize that. So, you know, the data that it owns is driving the strategic differentiation that Amazon has in the marketplace. That in a service-oriented architecture that helps to connect all of its content sets. And ultimately, you know, Google and Facebook and all of our other fast-moving intellectual capital-powered businesses are all really being driven. Their market value is ultimately being driven by content. We need to get the rest of the world to just catch up. This is already happening, right? It's already there.
Right, and that's a good question. It's like, you know, we've been talking about structure in TechCom for decades at this point, it seems like, and it finally seems like the marketing communication community is coming on board with that. How is that? Have you seen that evolution? And how has that adoption been on the MarCom side?
Well, marketing is interested in structure because of scale. Marketing is not interested in structure because of creativity. And so we have to find a way to bridge those things. Marketing really knows that that in order to be able to meet the need of a growing and divergent set of customer segments across large global geographies and you know, dozens and dozens of device types and interactions types, there's just no way to continue to develop experiences on a bespoke design-oriented model where we're building pages, right, and creating these chiseling these beautiful experiences. Experiences have to be assembled. Marketing understands that because, you know, there's just no way to scale. The reason there's so much interest in the work we're doing right now is because there's just undeniable realization that scale is impossible without structure and semantics and systems and processes behind it. It's literally a fool's errand to continue to throw people at copying and pasting. And what really kind of is just amazing to me is how many organizations have built themselves really entire divisions that are they have fancy names, but ultimately they're copy-paste farms.
Oh, wow.
And we're also turning our very valuable subject matter experts into copy-paste robots. And it's just human beings have so much more value to offer than transmitting and transforming content from Microsoft Word into Adobe AEM or Sitecore or other systems of record or CCMS. And really, as far as I can tell, the number one way that content moves around the enterprise today from authoring into management is via Microsoft Word files being emailed around or shared on SharePoint. And it's just unsustainable when we deal with variation in content and we deal with governance and we deal with orchestration. And so we have to evolve. When you ask organizations, you know, how their workflow works, in the initial dig, it always sounds much better. Like we're authoring in AEM and all of our management is happening there, and we're doing variation. variations on our account teams. But then when you really dig to how the content actually moves, we find, you know, massive inefficiencies at every step of the process. So a big part of how we do it is really by taking a broad brush into understanding the content publishing environment in its current state. And doing that by stakeholder interviews and workshops and surveys and requests for information and analyzing artifacts and existing taxonomies and workflows. And so our agents, that's what we call folks that work at A, are working to analyze those content sets and those people and those processes and help to map that into various graphs that we can represent back to our client and help people understand where within this manufacturing process of content we need to identify friction and where we need to remove that friction. Mm-hmm. And in some places we're finding that there's an opportunity to cut 80-90% of the effort associated with content production out. Literally, just because there's no content pipelines to connect our valuable content assets from one phase of production to the next. And we're asking our authors to do just too much. Mm. I mean, authors are being asked to be creative and match things to content workflows and to customer journeys, and then they're expected to pair things with creative, and then they're expected to add metadata and then start to annotate. And it, for anybody with semantic awareness, maybe authors are also being asked to semantically enrich the content. And you know, at some point, these content management interfaces start to become so hairy and so crazy that authors are just crying every time they open up a new asset. And so we just have to change that. There's too much pain out there. And so we have to design for not only customer experiences, but we really need to pair that with orchestration of the author experience. Because if we ignore our authors, we're really never going to get to the customer experience. It's a relationship between the customer context, and the author and the content workflow and life cycles. All of that has to come together in a gestalt that creates intelligence. It's not a single solution. And when somebody comes in with a single vendor piece of tech and says, this is the answer, it may be a part of the answer, but no single piece of tech is going to get us to content intelligence. There's just too much that is people and process oriented and structure and semantics oriented. So we have to look at content intelligence as a gestalt, as a whole, as an emergence of many 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 different origin dynamics that ultimately create an effect over time. So that's the challenge, is getting all of those parts identified and into a package that can be acted on iteratively. Because of course everybody's shipping donuts, everybody's creating content, publishing content as fast as they possibly can on their current treadmill, That's the thing. We've got to figure out, okay, there might be a better system. Let's not work just on production. Let's also work on innovation and transformation, and let's allocate budgets for that at a strategic level.
Yeah, wow. That's a lot to unpackage there. But I love your line, experiences have to be assembled, and that might be the title of our show. But it's really good, especially because it ties into the author experience. And yeah, I mean, you know, when you're a content creator, if you're like working in something like a wiki, like a Confluence, like you don't want to work in that all day. You get depressed, as a content creator, because it's just this box with some buttons, and it's just, yeah, it's not the way that I want to work. And that's really, really interesting. Also interesting to note that you're talking about things shared around in Word docs and emails and SharePoint, and there's no governance to it. And that's been our internal sales pitch when we talk to new businesses inside the firm that we want to try and get on board to our knowledge system, that it's like, oh, you know, you've got this stuff that's in SharePoint. It's in a Word document that someone created 10 years ago. No one knows who did it. The person that's did it moved on to two different departments or left the firm 3 years ago, you know, and it's passed around in network drives and all over the place. And once we say to these people, hey, we'll take this, all of it, and put it into a usable format that's searchable, that's leverageable by other teams within the firm, and it's going to be overall governed by someone other than them, it's an easy sell. So it's, you know, it's really interesting. And so how do you, well, what do you propose for content management systems to improve the author experience?
Well, you know, I think vendors need to understand that authors are not going to author in their platforms, and to just get over it.
Everybody
that has a SaaS app thinks that people are going to author in their platform. And I just hate to tell everybody, but it's not happening. Nobody's authoring in your platform. And if they are, they hate it. So what we have to do is get our content to be interoperable within an entire ecosystem. And all of the vendors need to start working towards passing schemas between systems of record and management. We have to be able to allow authors to author where they want to, which is in something largely unstructured, like that looks largely unstructured, like Microsoft Word, and be able to pass that then downstream to somebody who annotates, and then pass that to somebody within the authoring environment that then adds metadata and further enriches. So I think we need to look at content production processes as modular and interoperable, and content workflows as needing pipelines. We need our electricity to flow. And right now, our electricity stops within every system because everybody is trying to create a power plant. Every CMS thinks it's going to be the power plant for all content everywhere within an organization, and it's not going to happen. An organization needs to be able to pass content from system of record to system of record to system of management to system of presentation to another system that ends up delivering it as a service in modular tiny parts that can be queried as a JSON query or some other kind of on-demand utilization within a fragment use or within a virtual reality environment or within a voice application or reused in a learning module that an LMS is ingesting. Our content ecosystem has to dramatically evolve, and vendors need to get on board with that, because what the vendors are trying to do is lock each other out, and it's a fool's errand. It is an absolute fool's errand to try to lock in the customer to their content platform. It's a fool's errand, and organizations that do not provide interoperable content will die, will absolutely be dead. And it's not possible to lock customers in when they're dealing with complex content publishing environments that need to scale, because the enterprises will be the first to ditch the vendors that try to lock them in when they wake up, and they're waking up every minute now. So the largest customers will dump the CMSs that do not allow for portability. Right. But fortunately, the CEMs, the customer experience management platforms, the CMSs, and the CCMSs are all already heading in that direction. The SaaS vendors, the folks in the marketing MarTech landscape that Scott Brinker puts together, they haven't caught up yet, right? They're still in a happy bubble, but their happy bubble's going to break. And it's because they have to get on board with the CEM vendors that understand that content is a service ultimately. And so I believe a standard needs to emerge, or at least an agreement on a set of handoff protocols that can emerge to allow content to move from a SaaS system to a CMS and then out to a customer. And so what I'm imagining is that there would be a handshake where schemas are passed, where we can have a content model, a structural schema, be contained in one system of record that can be inherited to others. And so if I have a SaaS app, I can look for that handshake, and I can conform my SaaS app to the enterprise's standard for how an article is structured, not my standard. And so you know, that I think is a conversation that needs to happen and emerge in the industry. But ultimately, I think, you know, we just need to look at it from as an enterprise buyer, we need to look at our content as what's more important than our tech and get our tech to conform to our content. And the way we do that is by creating an orchestration layer of a content model that we at A, we call it the master content model. So we want to create a master content model, a master semantic model, a master metadata model that is system independent. And then we want that system independent content and structural and semantic standards to be represented within our various systems of record, within our CMS and our various SaaS apps and whatnot, without being a big giant integration project every single time. And today it is. Today it's a integration project. Only the largest companies can keep up with that. And that's why that's who we're working with. But, you know, ultimately the market is going to need to evolve standards so that the rest of the market can interact with content portability as well. And as it, without having to do manual integrations between every single content system.
Yeah, that's what we've done. We basically created a data to confluence workflow and the glue in between. And, you know, it's a hassle, of course, because like you said, you know, we're getting all our content in Word. And there's not been a particularly easy way to get large volumes of content out of Word and into a structured format without copying and pasting or going out into a text editor and cleaning up. And really, it's that is a large part of my process that I would really love to eliminate. And it's kind of driving me crazy.
Well, and you know, the word origination is something that I don't think we're going to get rid of. And so the way we've been, we've been addressing that, and I can speak about this one publicly because we've spoken about it together publicly, and we have that permission. At the Mayo Clinic, we're working to transform the content process from being Microsoft Word unstructured to being Microsoft Word but XML delivery against a master content model that is informed by DITA. So DITA is helping to guide, because there's a lot of good things about DITA, but there's a lot of stuff that's overhead that's unnecessary. And so hence, you know, the movement towards lean DITA. But any one standard can't really contain any single organization's total knowledge landscape. It's just not really tenable to try to assume that any external standard will be able to represent any internal reality, right? It's because somebody else has built a map doesn't mean they understand our territory.
Right.
And so we need to build our own map of the territory. That's what we call the master content model. So at the Mayo Clinic, we worked on creating a master content model that we're now in the process of implementing against a Microsoft Word authoring environment so that we can actually export XML out of Microsoft Word that will transform downstream into, in their case, its Sitecore.
Okay.
And so how do we get that structured XML into Sitecore as a CEM and then downstream further into a real-time content API. But of course, we can also transform it from XML into other presentations as well.
Right.
And then we can transform it and enrich it for voice downstream as well. So we can author it in one place and then enrich it in other systems of record that are presentation specific, like voice interaction and the algorithms and customer context and customer dependency parts of that, which can happen all downstream from maybe the part of it that was authored by the subject matter expert in Word. Originally. So we can divide up the process, make it more modular, and then create the workflows accordingly.
It's interesting. Earlier this week, I had a conversation with someone who does somewhat similar to what we do, but he was complaining about what I call trapped content. And like I think you said too, it's trapped content. It's not useful. He can't get it out of the former content management system. I think it was a wiki. And he's like, I just don't know what to do. So that makes me happy that, you know, we're in that DITA, which is essentially, like you said, a source format, and we can export it to HTML. Or we're actually looking into do, you know, XML to JSON, so that way we could do it as a you know, so that way we can get it ingested through an API. But it's, you know, I that trap content, I also consider PDFs a trap content too, because you can't get that information out of it easily. So, I think one of the things I actually wanted to ask you, and this might be a little bit upstream or downstream, sorry, from where you are, but there's a proliferation of simple, markup languages like Markdown, restructured text, ASCII doc. Is that something that's viable for the structured content world or the world that you're envisioning where everything's basically handing off pretty much seamlessly?
You know, I think it is. There's some parts of the structured content community that think of Markdown as basically lazy, right? Because it's not real semantic markup and whatnot. But the reality is, it is real. It's just real for the kind of author that needs to be able to rapidly denote presentation within an ASCII-oriented authoring environment. There's a whole movement around, automatically creating docs out of comments and within code and ingesting ASCII-based workflows that sort of automatically render content. And I support that movement because I believe ultimately there is a real benefit in creating content pipelines between the technologists, the subject matter experts that are developing the code, and the documentation events that are resulting from it. And so we need to use Markdown as a source, but again, it needs to be mapped to something richer upstream. So Markdown without a master content model is just a formatting shortcut. There are ways to do semantic markup within Markdown, but it starts to get hairier and hairier, why not just use Markdown for the things it's really good at, which is the nimble authoring of structural cues, and then ingest that downstream, just like we would in using styles in Microsoft Word or something. We can use those style indicators to indicate a paragraph header or a pull quote or other presentation oriented markers. And so let's just look at Markdown like that. And as long as it's playing well with the rest of the structure, it can fit into the ecosystem just fine.
Yeah, it's interesting. Whenever I wanted to take like meeting notes or just jot some things down or just write some thoughts down or whatever, I would open up Word and I would start typing and I would use, styles or whatever. But now I've converted completely to using Visual Studio Code, which is a fantastic lightweight editor, and just Markdown for notes. And, it's got a simple conversion so I can send a PDF for to-do list to my teammate or my manager. And it's just been a crazy part of my workflow. But I mean, I don't know if that's something I'd want to work in every day, especially, I know you could do metadata. I just, for me, it just doesn't seem like there's enough richness there, like tables are a disaster to work with. And, I like working in the text editor, but I don't know if that's what I want to do all day. So how does that all work with the metadata and all that structure? You said it's possible to do some structure in there. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, sure. Essentially, the way we look at it is as a subset of the richer, the larger, richer model, structural model and semantic model. So we're just using it as a phase of the content.
Okay.
But, in the use case that you just described, you've got a really beautiful thing going on there, which is knowledge capture and reuse. And ultimately, what we need to be thinking of is creating knowledge assets for our organization, right? And so how do we get the best value out of those knowledge assets? And if those are notes that are being created, that's an ad hoc form of knowledge, and it needs to flow. And if we can capture those notes in a way that's got some structural markers on it, whether that's formatting oriented in Word or whether that's in Markdown and it's in an ASCII document that somebody's essentially writing in Visual Studio or any other editor of any form, great. Whatever works for the author, let's meet the authors where they are,
right,
and then let's enrich it later. Let's add the metadata later. And we can agree to
you know, we can agree to do tags that people, that all, everybody knows in Markdown and ingest those, or we could just add the annotation later as it moves down the pipeline. So we can pass that Markdown file it's perfectly fine to use GitHub. I mean, we've found a lot of enterprises that sure do love GitHub for a content management repository, and it's not a CMS, but it's fine for us to store XML or store Markdown or store, to store Word documents in a content managed or a version managed version control repository, and then pull that and ingest that into a structured process down the way. We just can't stop there. And a lot of organizations sort of stop there, and so content can't flow. But if we can capture the knowledge, capture and reuse, capture and ante up, capture and leverage, that's what we're really trying to get to.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's, that's another selling point that we've said is that, you know, there's when people leave the firm, well, that institutional knowledge is gone. And now we have a centralized place that people can go and get that knowledge. And it's not in someone's head or Joe down two cubes over who's going out on paternity leave for a week or two. It's pretty powerful, like you said, when you have that centralized body of knowledge or that orchestration where you can take and ingest anything essentially and put it into a usable format.
Indeed.
So why don't we talk a little bit differently? It seems like in the past couple of years, and I've talked about this with other guests, but it seems like especially in the techcom related fields, that there's just been a proliferation of job titles. And even last year when you spoke at LavaCon, you're mentioning content engineers, but I've heard content developers, information developers. There's all these different things, and it seems like it's fracturing. And I'm confused about, like, well, gee, am I a content strategist? Am I an architect? An information architect? Am I all of these things? And how do you sell that to a client? So I'm wondering, are we really confusing employers with all these different names and all these specializations, or are clients now asking for these kind of things?
There's the rub. There's a lot of organizational design innovation happening in the enterprise. We in the analyst and consulting sector are reflections of the enterprise sector. So we have to help to innovate and then also meet a client within their context of a particular corporate culture. But what is true is that regardless of the title, what we really, really need to look at is roles. Titles are pretty permeable, but let's look at the practices that need to be employed inside of an enterprise, divide those practices into disciplines, and figure out which roles inhabit and own those disciplines. So we know that to orchestrate content intelligence, we need structure and semantic intelligence being applied to our content sets on a persistent basis, not as a one-time project, not as something that they hire A to come in and build them a taxonomy and then they're intelligent. It just doesn't work that way, right? We can build a client a beautiful taxonomy. They can employ it, and that'll be a nice contributor to their overall ecosystem. But intelligence comes out of the patterns, processes, and rhythms associated with the intelligent deployment of the disciplines of content intelligence. So I'll define some of those. First of all, we really need to have a clean understanding of content strategy, and we need to have content strategy ownership. Content strategy has its own set of disciplines that are manifold and that overlap with structure and governance and the systems around content with content engineering. Content engineering we define as you know, the owners of the ultimate containers for structure and content portability and delivery. So it's where we overlap the strategic elements and get them represented within structural and semantic standards, like our master content model and our master semantic model. And then we get those mapped to delivery channels. And those delivery channels are then further represented by folks that that deal with IT and with content delivery infrastructure. And the content engineer has to make sure that the content sets will end up getting everything from content strategy in terms of in the intent of the text and its communication with various audiences, and the way that the content strategists define audiences and journeys and conversations within a customer experience, and then map the content sets to the structural norms that make that happen, and the systems of record that contain the semantic standard. So if we're going to talk about a particular product between groups and across authoring environments, we need to know that they mean the same thing because they are attached to a product information management system, or a PIM. And so we're able to pull in the PIM taxonomy as one of our semantic standards. And so we need somebody in the authoring process as well that is able to interact with structure. So we need some sort of semantic specialist. Now, whether what we call that person, whether they're called an information architect or a content producer or a semantic specialist or an annotation expert or content enrichment specialist, doesn't matter what we call them. We need somebody who cares about semantics as their job. And in most organizations, that just doesn't exist. So we need to understand, within content engineering, we define the disciplines as structure, semantics, schema, taxonomy, topology, markup. And each of those have an exponent in a set of individual skills. And so we need to be able to understand what those disciplines are, what the related skills are, and make sure those are represented within our publishing teams. It's the same thing with content operations. Content operations is usually defined relative to either product groups or within marketing teams that own the subject matter expertise. And so, if authoring is happening there or within product teams that own the technical communication and support related to their product on the TechCom side. We just need to make sure that those authors are all sharing a standard structural model for their content, and also using the same tagging, the same taxonomies associated with each of the assets they're producing, from whichever product team they're in. And so, it's that alignment between that authoring environment to authoring environment that enables the movement. And so we need people in those places helping to facilitate that. So again, I don't care about titles as much as just making sure that our clients really have a good sense for the roles that and skills that need to be represented within the teams, and then we can make those fit within the culture and the systems of a given enterprise.
Okay, fair enough. I think I'll call myself a content enrichment specialist then from now on. Yeah, there you go. But anyhow, I want to go back to something you said earlier that I think ties into this. And you said, that you find out your clients are each working on different parts of the content intelligence process. Now, can you kind of tell us what you mean by that, and, how you know, if I mean, how that fits into that culture. Like, oh, well, we've got, you know, Joe is creating a lot of Word docs, or this person is a specialist in tax, or, you know, happens to just know something about taxonomy. How does that all work together? Can you expand upon that?
Well, in every corner of the enterprise, there are very smart people working on this general problem every day. They're just solving it without executive sponsorship. And so what's happening is that all these smart people are innovating in a vacuum. And none of that stuff is getting connected from group to group. So, for example, you know, somebody from Tech Comms will call us up and have us work with them on a support chatbot standard or a master content model that of which Ditta is a denominator, and that then just works in Tech Comms, or they'll call us up and have us work on a content pipeline for chatbots. And then that content pipeline, the patterns related with that content pipeline are then not necessarily applied to anything else inside of the enterprise publishing workflow. So they've invested in intellectual property, you know, not inconsequentially, you know, is a material investment in a content pipeline and framework and approach that they now own, that they then don't apply anywhere else because it's just being used in this one place. And so there's this poverty of content intelligence, while there's a richness of smart people working on content intelligence. And so, to my mind, that's a shame. And what we really need to do is be bringing the band together. And so what most of our clients are already starting to do is take these little petri dishes of innovation and connect them at least at the a committee level. So there's sort of content steering committees and other groups like that are emerging, like communities of practice around content, where people from different parts of the enterprise are starting to talk and share best practices. But again, it's all bubbling up. What we really need to see is that for any of that to really matter, somebody with some authority to allocate cross-functional budgets needs to care. And so because the committees can only be so effective. Who's got time to really invest in innovation at a systemic level, cross-functional level, when their budget is being allocated to ship out X amount of content in a given time frame, and that X number is escalating at unsustainable rates?
Amen. You know, amen. So what do we need to be paying attention to then? And what is senior management paying attention to that can bubble down to us as technical communicators, maybe marketing communicators, people in the content world? What should we be looking at? Is it bots? Is it customization? Is it IA? And how do senior managers kind of think of these things? Is it just a business asset, or is there more to it than that?
Well, you know, I think from an executive level, we just need to start understanding what content assets are, where they are inside of an enterprise, and how they are generating value, and what kind of cost sets are involved there. We need to start getting conscious as executives about the P&L behind our content. So, what is the top line revenue, a top line value that our content is actually generating for our enterprise? And then what is the cost side of that? Really looking at the cost side of that is an unbelievably challenging thing to do because cost is spread out. At the Mayo Clinic, again, a public number, Jay, there that runs patient education, which is a huge publishing organization, has estimated that it would save anywhere from 40 to 60% of his subject matter experts' authoring cycles to if they were able to eliminate content transformation from their workflow. So copying and pasting. And because there's literally 40 to 60% of their content authors' time is being spent on transformation of some form. So quantify it. How much effort is an authoring process really taking? At another very large global business-to-business technology company that we were working with, that we currently are working with, we found that a large number of cycles are being spent in copying and pasting variations between, and literally in the hundreds or thousands of variations, and that these are all AEM records. So there's different content items within AEM that are being generated with redundant content being copied and pasted by a, they don't call it a copy paste farm. I think it's called content operations. That entire effort, if there was structural reuse and assembly, could be netted way, way down, and they'd have the ability to then start really customizing the client experiences that they're trying to facilitate at a much more mature level, instead of spending all this human effort to just transform the content. And so, you know, really, we need to look at the cost side, understand the cost, and then really put a number on it. Put a number on the top line. How much is our content actually generating us in terms of value, and can we prove that? Put a number on the bottom line. How much is our content costing us at all of its and it's spread out in all of these authoring groups? That number might take a long time to figure out. But we could do back of the napkin math and understand what the salary load is for authoring groups and how much percentage of their time is spent on a given X, and then just sort of estimate it big chunky style, which is fine. But as executives, we need to get conscious about content assets, what value they generate for the organization, what the cost level is, and then that will make it super clear that it is absolutely unimpeachably a breach of a dereliction of duty to ignore the most valuable assets in our business anymore. Data, they say data is the most valuable asset. Really, that's not true. Data and content that we generate, data and the knowledge we interact with, customers, context, data, and our enterprise content together, that is the most valuable asset we have. Organizations are starting to quantify the data side, but we haven't really started to quantify the content side, and that has got to change. And executives need to pay attention right now, because the ones that really aren't paying attention right now are spending their time on these broad, ill-defined content transformation or digital transformation projects that are often not entirely understanding the value of the asset itself within that process. And digital transformation nets down to customer interactions with our knowledge. And if we cannot get our content orchestrated to meet those customer interactions, we're going to end up in a pretty sad state where we have overinvested in technology, but our content can't keep up with our technology, and everything breaks. And we've seen that now in some of the most resource-rich organizations in the world, where money is not the problem. It's just truly that it's not a tech purchase. It is a process of maturing and making the content itself more intelligent, the assets itself more intelligent to interact with all of that tech. And so it's not just a function of having deep pockets. It's really a function of intelligently deploying and understanding how to work with content assets.
Right. But, you know, to go back to your point, if it's done right, isn't really content just data? I mean, I know there's a big movement, and I think Ann Rockley's involved with the whole docs as code movement. So really isn't, like you said, enterprises and companies are considering their data you know, they're an important asset, but isn't, if you think about it in the right context, isn't content just another piece of that valuable data?
Well, you know, I've got a whole talk on this. So I believe that data is the kernel representation of facts, that when we add context to it becomes information, and that when we add context to our information, we put information in relationship or in graph relationship with each other, with other information, we then begin to be able to represent knowledge. And then when we have a lot of knowledge within an organization and we're able to relate that together and create patterns between that and then add some form of engagement with that, that becomes intelligence. And that when we combine that intelligence with customer context, then we create what A calls active intelligence. And so ultimately we believe that what we're really creating is active intelligence, but and its sources from the kernel of data. But looking at data as content is an immature point of view. I used to have it. I used to own that. Well, it's all, you know, at the end of the day, it's data in some system somewhere, so content is data. But no, really, data is just a representation of fact. Like, for example, I'll give you an analogy that might tie it together. I've spoken about this. You know, if we have let's say a string like 42 66. Okay, so 42 66, what does that number mean, right? If you don't have a reference for it, that's just it's a number, it's a string, it's a piece of data. That's data. But if we say 42 66 Main Street, then all of a sudden, with that additional context, with the addition of Main Street, which is another piece of data, to the 4266, now the two items together become information, because that is the beginning of an address. You can understand as a human being with that context that 4266 represents an address. Now, if we put more data associated with that address, like a city and a state and a zip code, then you've got a complete, accurate representation of a piece of information. But then when you start putting other information to that, like which company is at that address and who their executives are and what they produce and what their annual revenue was last year and who the number of employees that they have and their tech stack and whatever, that starts to become knowledge. And then that knowledge, when we have enough of it relative to a broader ecosystem, and we can act on it, we can do something with that knowledge, like present, like figure out what offer to target to that customer at that address. You know, that becomes intelligence, and when our customer comes to our website and we create a bunch of data about that customer and what they're interested in based on their behavior, clicking through their click stream and their interaction data and their chatbot transcripts and their visible manifestation of their intent, and we put that in a graph, we can then associate that with our intelligence and create interactions that form active intelligence. So let's not look at it as simple as data. Let's understand it's part of an ecosystem that is a much bigger picture.
That's a really good description. That's just a good deep dive into it all. It's like, you know, how does this all come? You know, that makes sense to me. I get what you're saying now. So, you know, it's like, you know, in a data, a task topic wouldn't be an actual piece of content without steps and stuff like that in it. So I get what you're saying now. It's the context that makes the difference between content and data.
And you can think about this in terms of the way our brains work. Our brains really only understand things relative to other nodes of experience and other entities of aggregated understanding within our brains. And so when I encounter something that that looks like a handle on a door, I kind of know how it's going to work because I've seen other things like it before. And so when we're babies growing up, we develop associations between our pieces of data. Like, and then as we create other variations, we look at different kinds of doorknobs and how they work. We no longer have to assess that every single time and figure it out. Because we have a representational memory associated by reinforced connections in our brain between, you know, based on what happens when we twist a doorknob. And so it becomes implicit knowledge at some point. And so, you know, really when we're working with any knowledge set, we're creating connections. And so when we're doing that with between customers and an enterprise, we're mapping an enterprise's rich connections with the customer's poor connections because they don't know our domain. And so we have to find ways to connect to what the customer already knows, and that's the formation of collective knowledge. So customer experience is that interplay between our knowledge graph and their knowledge graph, and we have to find where the connections are and build on those over time. And then we try to, as an enterprise, graph what our customers understand and evolve that over time.
That's a lot to think about. Holy cow. I'm going to have a beer and think about all this. I realized when I was doing my research that that AA has a podcast, and I believe you just finished recording up your podcast. And I realized also that I haven't subscribed to it yet, so that's going to change soon. But can you tell us a little bit more about your podcast and how that came about and who you're talking to?
Well, sure. We just call it Towards a Smarter World, and we're really nascent. I have to admit, we only have 8 episodes at this recording date and time. But the podcast endeavors to work through these same kind of issues we've been talking about today with people that have been interacting with various parts of the content intelligence landscape. And you know, ultimately, we'd like to work more and more with clients and enterprise stakeholders that are solving these problems internally and help to share some of the beautiful things that we've been hearing within the context of NDA-bound relationships. At A, we do a lot of NDAs, and we consider ourselves the content intelligence service because we're really forming a platform, and many times a lot of the knowledge that we're developing is very proprietary, and we need to respect that within an organization, and the content sets relate, but there's such incredible patterns that enterprises have been innovating, and we'd love to expose some of those as the client is willing to make some of those internal processes more public through the podcast, because you know I believe we can learn from each other in order to get towards a smarter world. We can't isolate, and that's why I love the conference circuit, because there's just such good interactions happening at LavaCon and Intelligent Content Conference and Information Development World and Information Energy and other kind of environments where the STC conferences is one, but then there's also some of the content strategy side like Confab. You know, there's these different practitioners coming together to talk about different parts of the content ecosystem as a whole. And I think we need to get the band together as all of us, really as all of us as human beings. We're trying to create more pathways for our intelligence to interact with each other so that as a race, we can keep up with the machines. And also, you know, ultimately, we want to be able to keep our intelligence moving, because that's the way that it gets value. Like if we're just smart in a vacuum in a dark empty room and we never communicate that intelligence, you know, we are basically robbing the human race of our understood intelligence, right? Our understood experience, our the richness of what we know. And if same thing as an enterprise, if we create a bunch of monolithic content assets that sit behind a paywall, in PDFs, doing nobody any good, you know, we're not getting the most out of those valuable content assets. Can we use those content assets to be exposed to the world, at least in some form, so that we can attract and connect customer conversations and constituent interactions with our enterprise because of those knowledge assets? And can we take those ones that are even publicly out there, but nobody can find because they are they're not schema enriched and made available for the robots that want to find them to bring them to humans? You know, we need to be able to address structure from that end too. So, you know, really we're needing to look holistically as a industry at content, you know, from all of its different parts and bring that conversation together. And I hope that A can have some small part in that.
Cool. So it's where can we find the podcast? It's at simpleA.com/podcast, or is there a different URL you have for it?
Yeah, it is up at simpleA.com/resources/podcast. But if you go through our resources section at simpleA.com, you'll find it, or also available through popular podcast services like Apple's. I heard that Google just released one, so we'll of course be adding that markup as well. So, because we of course we're interested in content portability, and you know, really with our other kinds of resources, we're working on creating our own master content model and finding ways to republish and reuse it as well, because we want to be able to use our own use case as an exemplar.
Yeah, Google Play Music has had podcasts for a while, but this is their first podcast app. But I think it just links back to their Play Music app. It seems extraordinarily basic. Of course, I have it, and I've been evaluating other podcast clients, but it just seems, I don't think it's ready for prime time just yet, but it'll be interesting to see where they go with it. So, yeah. But yes, we are, for the record, we are also on Apple iTunes. We're also on TuneIn Radio and Google Play Music. So go out there and subscribe. So Cruz, you sound like you're a busy guy, but what do you like to talk about when you don't talk about content?
You know, I just spent an incredible week with a good friend in the far north, hiking and looking at nature and skipping stones.
Nice.
And talking philosophy. And so those are the kinds of things I personally love. Human knowledge in all of its forms. And so even when I'm not talking about content, most of the time, I'm fairly obsessed with human knowledge in some form or permutation of it, because there's so many dimensions to what our beings are capable of, you know, both as individual representative egos and all of our points of view, but also I think as a macro, at the macro level, as sort of the information space that we all partake in and participate in and maybe emerge out of, depending on your philosophical inclinations. And so, you know, I see that field of information as endlessly interesting. I love travel for that reason, because there's different windows on experience. I love museums and libraries because they're representative of various kinds of human intelligence and creativity expressed. I love theater. I'm a huge, huge fan of theater, and I used to annually go out to Ashland. I haven't been able to get out in a few years because of needing to take care of some things on the home front, but I love participating in local theater as a consumer.
Okay.
At least in Austin, Texas.
Nice.
And New York whenever I'm there, and any city whenever I'm there, and so you know, and I find that that theater is a really interesting interaction with structured content that that is being creatively expressed, and so this is really within large content sets. I see the same thing. It's like, how do we marry creativity and structure? How do we take something like a script and creatively express it? How can we take things like notes for an orchestra and express those creatively within, lots of different orchestras across the world, and have that be a unique experience, customer experience, for the people that buy tickets to that performance. And, in all cases, there's an interplay of intelligence, which is born of content, or it's born of structure and semantics. Even in art, where we deal with sacred geometry and the forms and architecture, which has other structure and semantics. So all of those things are representations of intelligence. And I'm a pattern person, and so I love doing that. And, I also end up reading interesting fiction and whatnot whenever I can get time for it and make the time for it. I'm really an avid consumer of curated social media as well. I find that those streams are interesting, although I have to make sure that I don't consume too much. I think as all of us know, we create a lot of references in our brains, but what are we feeding our brains? What are we feeding? And if what we're feeding ourselves all of the time is arguments about the political state, the terrible and challenging times that we find ourselves within, there's so many incredible things happening as well. Can we feed ourselves some alternate things besides the trolls and the hate that's out there sometimes? Can we kind of curate that without being Pollyanna about it? But my goodness, there's so many good things about the human race. Let's take time to notice the good, amazing parts of human intelligence and how it's being employed on the planet, because there's a lot of good, wholesome stuff out there that is representative of the positive side of the human race. And if all we're consuming in our social media feeds is the vitriol, no matter whether it's justified or not, our umbrage is not going to create any new intelligence in the world. All it does is drag us down. And if we keep feeding our egos with umbrage, then all we will be is isolated, sad people and committing suicide at higher and higher rates. And that's just silly. We need to really kind of decide as a human race to appeal to our higher ideals and to the intelligence that is our gift birthright. As we come into this planet, we have intelligence available to us at almost infinite capacity. And why not tap into that instead of choosing the dark path? And so, I think there's some really interesting things to encounter in this wide world that we get to choose on a day-to-day basis what to pay attention to. So I'm always interested in curation approaches to content as consumers, so that we can begin to make choices for ourselves about what we're feeding our brains, while still maintaining awareness of the whole.
Well, I can't think of a more elegant way to wrap up a podcast than that. So thank you very much. Cruz, can you tell us what conferences that we might find you at later this year?
Oh, sure. Well, in 2018, a little later this year, I'll be at LavaCon. And I think it's very possible several agents will be at various conferences. I am blanking on the others, but you could follow us at simplea.com and take a look at some of the events that are posted up there, and we're always looking for opportunities to spread the good word. We've got we just did a really interesting introduction to content engineering a course for University of Washington in talks with others. We think that content engineering needs to be involved in the curriculum of higher education, and ultimately even within high schools or even grade schools, because structure is something that, as we're forming our understanding of language, I think eventually more of us need to be aware of how language can work besides big chunky blocks. And, you know, so that's something for the educational system.
Awesome. So can you tell us where we can follow you and Simple A or A on Twitter?
Sure. At Simple A Team,
okay,
is the company stream maintained by our marketing team. And then at Mr. Cruce, M-R-C-R-U-C-E, is how to follow me on Twitter.
Cool. And you can find me on Twitter at Ed Marsh. Of course, you can find more about me and the podcast at edmarsh.com. And you can subscribe to the podcast, find all our prior episodes at edmarsh.com/podcast. Cruce, thanks again. That was some amazing insights, some really deep dives into a lot of different stuff. So thanks again for your time. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate the invitation, Ed. Thanks
for having me. Awesome. And I will see you at LavaCon. So everyone, go out there and create some better content.